Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. You know, it seems like we are finding more and more invasive plants in our Wisconsin landscape, and today we'll be talking about ways to get rid of some of them. And our guest, Mark Renz. Mark is a professor and extension weed specialist with the UW-Madison. He researches and shares information about the biology and management of invasive plants. He's been with us many times. It's great to have him back. Do you have invasives on your property? What are you doing to keep them under control? What questions do you have about invasive plants? Join in. Give a call. The number 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Shoot us an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Mark Renz, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Hey, Larry, how are you? It's a pleasure always to come talk and share some of my experiences and learn from some of your listeners. So great to be here.
Well, it's going to be, it's always a lot of fun. Invasive plants. How do you define an invasive species?
Yeah, it's a great place to start, Larry. You know, and there is actually some official definitions. We have a state official definition. There's a federal executive order that defines it. And there's a lot of confusion around that, particularly comparing invasive species or plants to weeds. And so really, an invasive plant that needs to have three things. It needs to be not native to the area that you're present and the plant is. It needs to be able to spread and dominate an area, mm-hmm. and it needs to cause some type of impact, whether it's impact like we have wild parsnip, which can burn our skin. We have poisonous plants. We can have ones that impact like the economy, such as some agricultural weeds that are invasive and impact production. So really not native, spread and be a problem and cause some type of impact or have the potential. So the biggest mistake comes in something like box elder, which everyone thinks, oh, that's an invasive plant, right? Well, we can't call box elder invasive. And you know why, Larry? I'll give you a guess.
Well, it's not native?
It's native to Wisconsin. So we can't call it invasive, but we can call it a weed and we don't have to like it, but it's not invasive.
Well, you know, weeds, that's a much broader definition, isn't it?
Right. And so the invasive issue is really one of the reasons that there's such a problem is they come here from other places and they don't have some of the predators and other things that keep those populations in check. So they can just spread much more rapidly and cause much more problems. And so that's why we're concerned about them and trying to limit their impact.
So non-native plants, I mean, we have lots of non-native plants.
Correct.
That are not invasive, I guess.
Yeah, there's been some studies done, and they found anywhere from 1% to 3%, I believe, of non-native plants are actually considered invasive. So a very, very small percentage of plants that are not native that are actually really troublesome. And so I think that's the big thing that a lot of people get concerned about. Well, what about all these plants in my backyard that are not native? You know, we could talk about potatoes. Potatoes aren't native to Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. But corn's not native to Wisconsin. But we don't consider those invasive because they can't persist and be problematic without our influence. And so it's really a small subset.
Mary in northern Wisconsin, who called but couldn't stay with us, but has something going on in her lawn that's really hard for her to get rid of. In some ways, it looks similar to a rhubarb leaf. The leaves have a red stripe growing up the leaf, and when the leaves get larger, they look triangular. She sprayed them with a weed killer, and it doesn't do anything. It's growing in sunny and shady parts of the lawn, and they have really deep roots.
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple species that are kind of making familiar. It could be a pokeweed species, which we have a native and an invasive version. That's the first one that comes up. It's just sprouting up now, and it has that really red stem. But it could be several other species, too. And so I think the best thing for her to do is to take a picture and just email me that picture or get that picture to me, and then we can work on getting it identified. She can also talk with her local county extension educator, or she could just send one to me. I'll just give my email, mrenz@wisc.edu, mrenz@wisc.edu, and we'll try our best to get it identified. That's the first step, is to figure out what you have, because management is species specific.
Yeah, and that's maybe why the material that she was putting on it wasn't working, because it wasn't specific to that particular plant.
Right, or it was maybe you need to apply it in the fall versus the spring, too. That's another common scenario.
Yeah, and Amy and Cronenwetter said she couldn't stay with her. She has a poison ivy and poison oak in her suburban yard.
Yeah.
What could she plant to push those poison plants out?
Yeah, so poison ivies really can be a challenge, because obviously we can get it's actually a really interesting plant, so I'm going to geek out on plants with you, Larry.
Sure.
I think you'll be with me on this. So it actually has oils, and it's the oils that get on your skin and can cause these really bad rashes and blisters. But there's a large population that are completely tolerant to that and have no response to those oils. Also, what's really interesting is over time you can change where you can be tolerant and you can become sensitive, and that can change over time. So there's really a lot of interesting social implications that's going around this plant. What's even more interesting with climate change, those poison ivy plants are producing more of those oils, which are more toxic. So it's getting worse to the problem. So it's bad. To get directly to our point, is what I would do is I would focus on, if it's a partially sunny area, trying to get some grasses in there. Because if you get some grasses in there, then you have some other plants that are competing with it. Then you can use a selective herbicide to get rid of it, or very carefully with lots of gloves, pulling those out and cutting those or mowing. But again, make sure none of those oils get on your skin, or you can get that rash too.
Unlike my friend who bought a new house, this is several years back, and on a warm day and shorts and went out there to pull those weeds that were out there, which turned out to be poison ivy.
Right.
What a mess.
Oh, exactly. Identification is critical. So it sounds like she's identified it. That's step one. So you know where it is and to isolate it. But you can be pretty careful with these. We work a lot and do a lot of research with wild parsnip. I've been here 20 years, Larry. I've yet to get a wild parsnip burn because I know the steps and how to mitigate or minimize my exposure to it. Unfortunately, my staff aren't as lucky, but I've been lucky so far. So there are opportunities to mitigate or minimize.
So how do you mitigate for that?
So wild parsnip is unique. Unlike poison ivy, everyone is susceptible to wild parsnip. But the issue with wild parsnip, it's the sap that needs to get on your skin and be exposed to sunlight. Oh. So if you never break the leaves or break the stem and get that sap on your skin, you'll never get it. So I'm really careful not to do that. And in the few instances that I did, I immediately picked up water or soil and rubbed it on that area. And that's binding to that chemical that causes that reaction. And so it eliminates it too. So you could be really careful.
That's a good tip.
Yeah, so have some water around, and if you get some sap on you, immediately do it, because that reaction starts right at day one. I'm sure some callers will come in and say, I've gotten it, and it's been miserable. It is. So be careful. Learn how to identify wild parsnip.
And speaking of callers, you can join in, too. The number's 800-642-1234. Or you could email, too, the email address talk@wpr.org. Which invasive plants, you know, just now thinking for the state, are most of concern right now, or the biggest concern, let's put it that way?
Yeah, I mean, I think that we do have some that are kind of on our doorstep and are like starting to come in that we're really concerned about, and early detection and rapid response. And so one that last year I was on the show, and this year we're continuing, is Japanese stiltgrass. It's actually an annual grass that establishes in understories of forests. So think of crabgrass, but it grows in shade and can grow almost like a vine-like in the understories of your forest. Yeah, it's bad. And so what happens when it gets in these forests, it's an annual, so that grass dies. And so it increases fire frequency. The fires tend to be hotter, and we can have some really severe impacts. So it's all over to the south of us. And we've started to see some small populations popping up in Wisconsin and Michigan. And so we're really trying to
jump on it,
get landowners, forest owners to learn how to identify it. Because it's easy to manage. Because how do you manage the crabgrass in your lawn, Larry?
I don't.
Okay, that's one option.
Pre-emergent.
Pre-emergent herbicides. That's what we're looking to. If we know it's there, we can apply herbicides before it germinates. It never grows, and it establishes. Work from Pennsylvania has shown that 1 to 2 years of intensive management can eradicate small populations. And so we're really optimistic if we can find them when they're small, we can get rid of them. And so we're working on a site in Rock County. DNR is working on a site in La Crosse, and we have a couple other land managers that are trying to eradicate. We have 4 known populations in Wisconsin right now. So that's one. The other, we have this lesser celandine, which we'll talk about, which is an early detector too. But I think we also need to think of the elephant in the closet. So we have some of these invasive species that have been here forever and are incredibly impactful. And we just kind of ignore them. And those are our invasive shrubs like buckthorn and our honeysuckle species. And pound for pound, those suckers do more impact than probably all the other invasive species combined, invasive plants at least, in Wisconsin, because they're just really are tremendously impacting our forests. So we're doing a lot of work trying to demonstrate effective control techniques, how to integrate restoration, and trying to get landowners to really tackle those dense thickets that people just have been ignoring.
Charles in Oshkosh has a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, Charles.
Hi. My mother was from Alabama, and we'd take the train down there from Oshkosh to see my grandparents, and they had a plant called kudzu that apparently was some sort of invasive species that covered everything, over trees, over stuff. I was curious if you knew about that. And also those pretty little flowers, I think they're purple and white, that grow along the highway. I've heard those are an invasive plant in Wisconsin. That's true.
Okay. Charles, thanks for calling. A couple of things there. Kudzu.
Yeah, so first, Charles, you're absolutely right. Kudzu is an invasive vine that's taking over the southern U.S. It is currently in Illinois, in Evanston. There are some populations actually in Canada, but it's actually farther south than we are in Wisconsin and those populations. So we don't have it yet. That's one we're definitely concerned about. It looks like it's less invasive up here in our colder climate, so we might be lucky. But with climate change, we're concerned about it spreading. So that's one we're really looking for actively, because it will just carpet everything, cars, fence posts,
trees. It's really depressing to drive through some areas in the south.
Absolutely, absolutely. So you're right. That is one we're really concerned about. And Charles, I have to say, you're very astute. That purple flower that's blooming right now is an invasive species called Dame's Rocket. It is common historically in a lot of seed mixes people put out. It's beautiful. Purple and white flowers on our roadsides flowering right now, but it is not native. People want to call it phlox. It is not phlox. The key to identifying and differentiate it from phlox usually flowers later, and phlox has 5 petals where Dame's Rocket has 4. So an easy one to control, but it's pretty widespread. You're very astute to observe that.
Mark Rims, our guest, weed science professor and extension specialist at UW-Madison. Great to have him with us. And you can join in, too. The number's 800-642-1234. You can email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. We are taking a look at invasive plant species today with our guest Mark Renz, weed science professor at UW-Madison. He's an extension specialist as well. It's great to have him back. And again, you can join us at 800-642-1234, email to talk@wpr.org. Quick note, we'll talk the history of turkey conservation in our state at noon today. And then later, we'll get an update about the whooping crane population. So a couple of other things going on there. You mentioned celandine, and there's another one. That's a pretty flower.
Yeah, it's gorgeous.
Yellow flower.
It's gorgeous. So what this is another one that we're concerned about, actually in the whole upper Midwest. So there was efforts between Michigan, Minnesota, and Wisconsin. There's a few isolated populations of this plant. And I'll describe this plant to the audience. So it's an ephemeral. It will emerge from late March to early April. And it starts flowering right around the end of April, early May, and has this beautiful flower that's like a silver dollar or maybe even the size like a daisy, just gorgeous. And it carpets the floors of these wet forests and other areas, and it looks beautiful, but it just dominates those areas and displaces a lot of our other ephemerals that are native. And so we've been really concerned about this, and I'll give you a good story. I was out visiting Cornell University, and I was just walking on campus, and their whole campus was loaded with it everywhere. And so I was like, we do not want this to happen in Wisconsin, right? We want to keep it at bay. And so we had a big outreach effort trying to get knowledge of where these infestations are and get information on how to control these before it becomes widespread and everywhere like it is in Pennsylvania and New York and other areas too. So this spring, you may have seen, and many of your listeners may have heard of an outreach effort where we're asking for people to report these new invasive species, the Lesser Celandine invasions. Because really, we only had a handful of counties that even had this, and it was really concentrated in the Milwaukee area. And so we, from our outreach campaign, we got close to 60 new observations by volunteers that just said, yeah, I've seen that plant when I'm walking around, and they reported them through a smartphone app or called us, and we confirmed those observations. We found populations in three new counties, in La Crosse County, in Washington County, and at Richland Center. And it's bad that it's spreading more, but it's good that we found them and they're relatively small populations. Now we're trying to get people to control those too. So it's been a real big positive response from the public.
Is it pretty much chemical control or?
Yeah, so it's another cool plant that it's a perennial and has these tubers that it produces on its roots. So it's really, really tough to get rid of. And those tubers can get washed down in if it's along a stream edge. So we're relying on herbicides, and the herbicides we rely on are non-selective, and so they kind of kill everything. So we really want to get them when those populations are small so we can get them out before they're widespread. I mean, you can go to Pennsylvania, and there'll be acres of it along these wet forest areas. It just is awful. So we're not there yet, with maybe a few exceptions in Milwaukee. We do have some options on control. We have a fact sheet on our website that people can look at, but we really wanted people to let us know where those infestations are. And they came out and told us very well. In Minnesota, we did a very similar thing with colleagues out there, and they found one new infestation out there, so less of a problem. In Michigan, they're worse off. They found 137 new infestations. So it's actively spreading. So that's why we want to keep people aware of that.
Jim in Madison has a question for you, or a comment. Let's go there. Hi, Jim.
Hi there. I'm battling a creeping bellflower, and it's just about got me to my knees. I'd like any advice you have.
Yeah, I mean, I think somehow someone in Madison decided they wanted to plant creeping bellflower and plant it in everyone's yard. I have the same battle as well with that, too. And why that plant is so challenging to control is it has a very deep perennial root. And you think when you pull it, and I've done this too, you think, oh, I got a bunch of the root, and you see this long, skinny root that you pull out. If you dig down a foot to 2 feet, you'll find like a root the size of your thumb or bigger that's attached to with all that stored energy. So it's a challenge to control. If it's in an isolated flower bed that's small, I've successfully eradicated it by digging up like a foot of soil, removing that soil, sifting through it, and removing all those fragments and putting it back in. Not very realistic in the large populations. In a lawn, I think just being really good about fertility of the lawn and appropriate maintenance of the lawn and then using a broadleaf herbicide will eventually take it out. In the flower beds is where it's really a challenge, where lots of mulch, hand pulling. Herbicides can suppress it, but they don't eradicate it. And then those flower beds, it's a lot of times really hard to apply those herbicides without getting them on other plants. So unfortunately, I don't have really good news on a bulletproof way. It's just persistence and really targeting those areas you really want to get rid of it and maybe living it with it in some of those other areas.
Yeah. Jim, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Bill in Boulder Junction, your turn. Hi, Bill.
Hi. How are you today?
Great. Appreciate the call. What can we do for you?
Well, I've been told that I have something at my property. We're on a lake, so I want to be really careful about using chemicals, but it's something called yellow archangel, which is apparently has moved from one category into another. And we've tried putting black plastic over it for a season. We've tried salt mixed with vinegar, I think, to spray it. And the only thing that really works is getting on hands and knees, digging up every square inch of soil and pulling out the whole root system. But
Well, we lost Bill, but I think we probably have enough to go on here, Mark.
Yeah, so that's definitely a non-native plant that was probably purposely planted. It actually has beautiful flowers, but we have noticed by a lot of people it's now spreading. It currently is not a regulated invasive plant in Wisconsin, but I believe it's being considered to be regulated in the new law that's ongoing. It has not been formalized yet. As far as management, it's another one of these perennials that's difficult to control because you got to get those creeping perennial roots. I know a little bit less about herbicide options. We want to be careful around water, obviously. Probably the soil solarization or tarping would work. The bad news is you probably need to keep that area solarized or tarped for like 4 to 5 years. That's been done with knotweeds to be effective. So we need many years. So in a small setting, that's just not realistic. So your best bet is probably to do hand pulling. If you can get some turf planted on there, then you could periodically mow that turf to keep it suppressed, but that's probably not going to eradicate it. But persistence and hand pulling can go a long way to reduce it. But it's another one of those that's really a challenge. Hopefully it's in just a small area where it is, because it can be challenging.
Yeah. Yellow archangel. What it is, I don't even know what it looks like.
Yeah, it has these small yellow flowers. And I think it's in the mint family, if I'm not mistaken. I'm forgetting what the scientific name is. But it's a beautiful ground cover like species, but it's very aggressive. And so I always tell people, when you're reading the description of a plant you're going to plant, and they say, like, needs no maintenance, really aggressive, that's like warning signs that it could take over your yard. So be careful when you hear read those comments.
Or it's in the mint family. That would be enough right there for me. Oh, man, to avoid it. Bill, thank you. I hope that helps. Marla in the UP of Michigan. Let's go there. Hi, Marla.
Hi, it's Maria, and thank you for taking my call. I am battling what I guess is known as Russian olive or possibly autumn olive, and we've tried a lot of different approaches, and I just wanted to see what you would recommend. We've cut it, and then that doesn't work, and so then we've cut some of it and left some leafy branches and applied herbicide.
Mm-hmm.
What can you tell me? We've got it pretty bad around here.
Yeah, that is another bad one. You guys, callers are coming in. Maria, I apologize. So autumn olive, we purposely planted for wildlife, and we made the mistake, thought it was good for wildlife, and we're now learning that the native plants are much better than some of these that we planted. The reason, Maria, it's so problematic, and it's autumn olive is probably the one you have, is it has a creeping perennial root. So if you just cut it, you'll see you'll get thousands of shoots that'll come back up. Because of that creeping perennial, so usually the most effective techniques involve herbicides. And you can apply herbicides to the foliage. You could do what you did, cut the surface and apply a concentrated dose to the cut surface, a cut stem or cut surface, cut stump application. We usually don't recommend the cut surface because when you cut it, you stimulate everything else to grow. And so that causes a problem. So usually what we recommend is a foliar application to the leaves or what's called a basal bark application. So that's where we're doing a concentrated form of a herbicide. Usually it's 10 to 20%, maybe 30% mixed in this bark oil. And you apply it to the base, the bottom 12 to 18 inches of the stem. And that is enough herbicide. It gets absorbed through the stem and can be effective. We have a fact sheet on our website. If you just Google Wren's Weed Science or Google Autumn Olive Wren's Weed Science, you'll see that fact sheet. And it'll give you details on which herbicides and the rates. But that should work a lot better. That would be one recommendation. Maria, the other one, if you don't want to use the concentrated herbicide, I would recommend cutting them all, letting them all resprout, And you may think that's crazy, but you want to wait and let it, those resprouts get like 3 to 4 feet tall, and then spray those resprouts with the foliage. Because what you're doing is getting that plant to use a lot of energy to regrow, and then it has a lot of leaf surface area, so you can get more herbicide on that plant, and you can use a dilute herbicide application and be effective. But it's going to look really bad for a year if you do cut those down. And so a lot of people don't like to do that.
Yeah, and when you're talking herbicides, what herbicides are you talking about?
Yeah, off the top of my head, I don't recall which are the most effective, so we'll have to refer to the fact sheets, but it's likely ones involving the active ingredient triclopyr mixed with some of the others, too. And so I'd have to look up that fact sheet to remember. That's why I wrote the fact sheet, so I didn't have to remember, Larry.
And again, to get to that fact sheet, it's Wren's?
Wren's Weed Science at cals.wisc.edu. So if you just Google Wren's Weed Science.
R-E-N-Z.
Yeah, R-E-N-Z. You'll get to it. Or send me an email, and I'm happy to send you that fact sheet.
Maria, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Excuse me. Let's go to Dale in Custer. Hi, Dale.
Hi. See, got a question about garlic mustard. We have it growing in our woods, and there's too much to hand pull.
Yep.
I'm wondering if I weed whacked it early in the spring and then just stayed on top of it so it would never have a chance to mature. Is that a possibility?
Absolutely. So garlic mustard is a biennial, so it germinates in the spring, stays as a rosette, which is just a bunch of leaves, and then the second year it flowers, that plant flowers, produces seeds, and dies. And so if you can prevent seed production, you can eradicate that plant. So your approach is spot on. Just target those flowering plants and don't let those flowers turn into fruit pods and go to seed. And so weed whacking is a great approach. The challenge, while you may not eradicate those, is those seed move around on, you know, the fur of critters and in soil that we move around and on our tractors and equipment. So we may not eradicate it, but you could definitely keep that population at bay by just controlling those plants that are flowering with a weed whacker. If you start to see those fruit pods, which we call them salix, start to form, you may have to bag those plants because they will produce viable seeds if you cut them while you see those fruit pods.
Dale, good luck, and thank you very much for calling. And Harry in Rock Falls, your turn. Hi, Harry.
Hi. I am calling about honeysuckle. Of course, that's one of those things that we planted in the past that we thought was good. But now, I know there's a good honeysuckle and a bad honeysuckle. And if I remember, one's hollow and one's not. Is that correct?
Correct. So a great way to identify these honeysuckles is the ones that are invasive and bad have a hollow stem. So if you cut like one of the stems that's like relatively small, like the size of your finger or a little bit less, you'll see the pith or the center of it becomes hollow as it turns into a woody material. So that's one good way. They're pretty distinct, though, too. If you can go to our website, we've got pictures with the lookalikes there as well. There also are different types of honeysuckle species that are present. So it could look quite a bit different because there's several different species, and they all hybridize. So they all like cavorting together, and it makes identification a little bit more difficult. You can have yellow flowers, white flowers, pink flowers. They can even sometimes be closer to red, too. But that what you describe is a good technique on identification.
Harry, good luck, and thank you very much for calling. And your website is?
wrensweedscience.cals.wisc.edu. And I apologize. We sometimes at the university don't make it easy.
Well, if you put in wrens.weedscience.
Yeah, Wren's Weed Science. If you Google that, it'll show up. Google knows where we are.
Okay. Well, we've got some emails, a number of them. Kathleen in Indiana emailed us, and she wanted to recommend the app Picture This for plant identification. She uses it constantly to figure out what mysterious things are in her yard. It's not free, but it's worth the cost for accurate identification of plants and trees, including invasives.
Yeah, and I think if I could comment on that. So it's been really interesting, the evolution of these identification apps, and there's a whole bunch of them out there. None of them are foolproof, so don't expect that answer is correct all the time when you use an app. There's been some great research out of Michigan State that they find that sometimes the apps are anywhere from right 50% of the time to upwards of 80% of the time. So be really cautious. If it says it's this plant, go to some other resources to confirm that. But I will say, I will agree with the caller, of all the apps we look at, picture this by far is the best. And so if you're going to use an app, use that one. The iNaturalist app, the identification is unfortunately not the best. It's one of the mediocre ones. So picture this is really good. It does cost money, but there's ways to skirt the system and have a free trial and keep that free trial going for free, too. So take a look at it if you want. I really would recommend picture this. Out of all the apps I've tried, it's by far the best.
Valerie in Boaz emailed, when's the best time to tackle poison parsnip? Should she wait until each plant has a seed head and then cut it off? Do you need to burn the plants you cut? Valerie tries to tackle it every July, but it never seems to make a difference.
Oh, that's a great question. We've actually done a bunch of research on wild parsnips. So if you are relying on mowing to control or cutting to control wild parsnip, you want to mow or cut that plant when you see the primary umbels start to flower. So the tops of the flower heads turn yellow, and when you just start to see the secondary ones, the ones just down off the top, just start to turn yellow, is when you want to mow that plant. Why we pick that timing is that that plant uses a whole bunch of energy to create those flowers, and so it regrows much more slowly. And that it will regrow and it may flower again. But Larry, what's cool is our seed growing season is so short, it doesn't have enough time to produce viable seed. So that one mowing will eliminate viable seed. We don't want to mow it earlier, because if we mow it earlier, it will be able to produce viable seed. And also, when it's flowering and we mow it, there's no viable seed present from that flowering. So if you can get that timing, which is really around late June, early July in southern Wisconsin, maybe closer to the first or second week in July in northern Wisconsin, you can, and I've talked to landowners where they've eradicated it by hitting that timing every year. But you got to do it every year. If you miss a year, you're back to ground zero, too. And the seed live in the soil for about 3 or 4 years.
Bill in Oregon emailed us, pokeweed appeared several years back and the rapid spread is suggesting the invasive variety. He's been letting them grow and cutting them at the base. Seems to slowly kill them. He tried pulling the Dame's Rocket, but there's likely years of seed in the area.
Yes.
He has changed his strategy to cutting off and disposing the tops after they flower. As a biennial, this should reduce them over time. Are there better non-herbicide strategies for these two plants, the pokeweed and the Dame's Rocket?
Yeah, I think the first thing to do would be to identify the pokeweed. We have an invasive one and a native one, too. The native one can be aggressive in some cases, too. So first get that identified. I don't really have a good recommendation on pokeweed. It's a challenge. It's a perennial, and so you want to be conscious of just depleting that stored energy below ground. The Dame's Rocket is actually, I'm 95% sure, a simple, short-lived perennial, not a biennial like garlic mustard. So it does persist for more than 2 years as a perennial. But you're right, there are a ton of seeds. I would just be persistent about pulling and preventing flowering. You can get a lot of the root if you pull. A lot of mulch would be a good option. Unfortunately, as we see it grows in these areas, we don't manage like the edge of the road, edge of the forest, and other areas too. And so that can be a challenge to manage it, preventing seed production and getting rid of that perennial root through repeated management are your best solutions if you're not interested in herbicides.
Randy emailed us from Stoughton. He said, creeping bellflower is taking over Stoughton neighborhoods and difficult to dig up, appears to be resistant to Roundup. Randy smothered a section for 2 years and it returned.
Yeah.
Many people keep the plant growing due to the pretty purple flowers. Outreach would be appreciated.
Well, we do have a fact sheet that kind of highlights some of the controls. There has been some work that shows that there are some herbicides that are more effective than glyphosate or Roundup. Unfortunately, they're not registered for use in urban settings, and so you can't use them in your flower beds and your other areas too, which is unfortunate. So persistence is the best option. What I tell people is if you can get it in a grass-based system where you can mow it or spray a herbicide that's safe to establish grasses, whether those are ornamental grasses or turf grass, then it's much easier to manage them than the hand pulling. But it's going to take many years of repeated work and just telling people just to be cautious. Don't plant this plant. Don't bring in contaminated soil. A lot of people will bring in the soil and it's in there, and then it's a problem too. I always tell people, when you're driving around, look at those areas that are giving away free soil. Look what's growing on those soil piles. There's just weeds and invasive plants. And that's what you're bringing into your property when you get those too. So try to bring in weed-free material if at all possible.
Absolutely. Vernon Boyd wondered about tumbleweeds. He says they're invasive out west. Do we have anything like that here in Wisconsin?
Good question. So we actually do. Tumbleweeds are actually a couple different species. Kochia scoparia is one of them, which is wild kochia. And then we have a bunch of, we call them Russian thistles. They have actually changed the scientific name. There are several of them. We do occasionally see those in Wisconsin, kochia particularly on roadsides. But with the number of those are much less, because what do we have when we look on our roadsides and into our natural areas is a bunch of green grass growing there. Where when you go out west, it's a bunch of desert and other areas where there's opportunities for these to grow. So we just don't have as many opportunities for these tumbleweeds to grow and establish. So when they do grow, they're not very competitive, and we don't have the numbers. When you will see them, they probably be in our central sands or our areas where we have really sandy soils. But you don't see them anywhere like you do. Like, you go out west and you see them lined up on the fence rows, just piled up. Nothing like that here. So we're benefit from having moisture year-round and having lots of vegetation.
Mark Renz, our guest today, weed science professor and UW Extension specialist. It's great to have him with us as we talk invasive species. Questions, you can give a call. The number is 800-642-1234, or email us to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you with us for WPR News. Larry Mueller here talking invasive plants with our guest Mark Renz, weed science professor at UW-Madison and UW Extension. Great to have him with us. And you can join in too with your own questions or comments. The number is 800-642-1234. You could email us to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. I think you mentioned at the beginning of the show, or near the beginning, Japanese stilt grass. Mm-hmm. Somebody's wondering what that looks like.
Yeah, you know, it's an annual grass that germinates really early in the spring, like March or April. And for a grass, it has a very wide blade, but it grows in these forests, so it's really hard to see the seedlings. So probably about now, it would be about 3 or 4 inches tall.
Oh.
Probably surrounded by a bunch of other vegetation in the understories of forests. And we have some videos on our website and our Wisconsin First Detector Network. If you Google Japanese stiltgrass identification, it'll come right up. Really, it's late July and early August is when it becomes a lot easier to identify. And it's tough to identify, Larry. I won't kid you, because it's a grass. And it looks very similar to our Leerzia species, which are native. But there are some key ways to differentiate it. I'd encourage you to watch the video, because we have pictures side by side and examples. And just tell the listener, if you think you see something, just let us know. Send us images, and we can easily identify it from those images. But that's a challenge. That's what we like to call a 10 out of 10 on the identification difficulty.
What about, what is it, golden creeper? I think a red hailstone, is it called, or something like that?
Yeah, this is this vine that, again, came in. It's an ornamental plant. It produces these really beautiful yellow flowers, and it's a creeping vine with heart-shaped leaves. But it can just take over these areas. And we have it on our riverway systems. And what's the problem with that one is it creates these like tubers that almost look like a potato, and they float down the river and land in the riparian areas, and they climb up in the trees and cause all sorts of problems. So that's something we're concerned about in the Southwest. There's some populations in Madison and some people's yards that are trying to get rid of. It's hard to control. There are some options that can work, and they found some recently in Walworth County too, but it's relatively isolated, so we're trying to keep it down. What the good news is, all the plants we're finding are male, so we don't have any of the females. The reason they call it red hailstone is the fruit looks like a hailstone, but it's colored red. But we don't ever see the fruit because we don't have any of the females. So that's what makes it difficult to know the name. So it's an interesting species, too. It's another one to keep a lookout for.
Jerry in Kokana has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Jerry.
Yes. Thank you for the show.
Sure.
Is there a way, easy way to get rid of, like, foxtail and Canadian rye?
Yeah, so I think those are two different grasses. So foxtail is an annual grass, and so depending on the system where it is, you know, repeated mowing can be an issue, can be effective if you have competitive grasses in there. The Canadian rye is a perennial, and so it's much more difficult. I'm going to go out on a limb and say you're concerned about it because of the fruit that it produces has long awns, and that usually gets into dogs, and that can get into their ears and cause issues. Is that the problem?
Got it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's really it can be a challenge because those are probably talking about natural areas. So I think the foxtails, you have a better approach. There are pre-emergent herbicides that can be applied, or you could do timed mowing and keep that plant really small where it's less of an issue. It's the rye that's really a problem, and that could be really detrimental to dogs in particular. And I know dog owners have had to have surgery where they get those awns out. So the short answer is, if you have lots of it, there's no easy solution. You could go out and mow those out or remove those, but if you have acres that you're trying to hunt or visit, it really can be a challenge.
Yeah, yeah. Sorry, Jerry. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Lynn in La Crosse, we'll go to you. Hi, Lynn.
Hi, yes. I have outdoor cats, my beloved farm cats, and I have Creeping Charlie in my lawn that's just spreading, mm-hmm. and I want to get rid of it, but I'm afraid of the chemicals with my cats.
Ah, well, this is great because I have three cats too, and one of them loves to be outside, and I just sprayed my lawn. So I'll tell you what I did to mitigate that issue, because it is a concern. We want to obviously limit chemical exposure to us as well as the other animals and creatures we love. So what I do is I make an application. Like I was leaving for work. So right before I left to work, I put all the cats inside, made an application to my lawn, and then I let that sit for 2 to 3 hours at least. And then I actually left and did some field work. I came back in. And then what I did, and this is going to sound counterintuitive, I actually took the garden hose and I watered that lawn very thoroughly. And what I'm doing is I'm washing that herbicide off of the leaves into the soil. And then you let that area dry, and then that herbicide isn't available for your animals to take up. And hopefully enough of that herbicide has been taken up that will kill that Creeping Charlie. So that's what I do to mitigate it. There's no perfect solution, but I think, to me, that's a pretty successful option that works well. The key is don't let those cats or animals back out till that lawn is dried, and that can mitigate that impact to a certain degree. There are some other herbicides that are sold as, you know, safe to pets, but those tend to also harm the grasses. So you don't want to broadcast those because they'll kill everything.
Lynn, there you go. Appreciate your call. Tim in Sturgeon Bay, your turn. Hi, Tim.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I recently moved to Sturgeon Bay, and we have 2 acres behind us full of honeysuckle, and I heard a discussion already about it, but somebody told me it's not beneficial to cut it and apply herbicide right now, but we should wait until the early summer or later on while the sap isn't going up into the leaves.
Yeah. So, well, thanks for your call. No, we're actually doing a lot of work on honeysuckle and other invasive woodies like buckthorn, and you really have options on how to control it. One option is to do this cut surface application where you cut the plant and apply a concentrated solution to the leaves, to the cut surface. We're usually applying anywhere from 10 to 50% of the concentrated herbicide, depending on which herbicide you use. And that tends to work really well. And that you can do that any time of the year, winter or spring or summer. You just want to avoid when you have that sap flow going up, as you mentioned. I was just out, we were starting a research project on honeysuckle, and we were cutting them all last week, and we did not see that sap flow. So I think it probably would be safe, or it may still be occurring up in your neck of the woods. Maybe cut one and see if you see that sap flow. My guess is as soon, if not in the near term, as you would be able to make that application. You could also apply to the foliage. If you have 2 acres, that might be a lot of work. And so another thing that you might want to consider is this forestry mower, where you get a really industrial-sized mower that goes into these forests. It can mow those bush honeysuckle and trees up to like 6 inches in diameter. You can have that come in. They're usually $100 to $150 an hour, and they can do around an acre or so in an hour. So it'll cost you a couple hundred bucks, maybe $500. And then those plants won't die. Those shrubs will resprout. You let them resprout and wait till they get 3 feet tall, and then you can treat them, the leaves, with a foliar herbicide. And that's a lot less herbicide and a lot less work than you going out there cutting yourself.
Yeah, I kind of like that latter one. I wouldn't want to go out and have to do a large area.
Right. We just finished a research project looking at that. It can be expensive to do that, but it's a lot more effective. And then you open up so good stuff can come in and grow too.
Yeah. Tim, does that help?
Yeah, that's wonderful. Yeah, let somebody else do the hard work, and I'll do the easy stuff. Thank you very much.
Yeah, and Tim, we have on our website, we have some demos and some outreach material that highlights how we've done this and some of those results. So go check that out or send me an email, and I can send you that information.
Yeah, and checking it out at Wren's Weeds. Huh?
Wren's Weed Science at cals.wisc.edu. But just Google Wren's Weed Science.
Wren's Weed Science is the easy way. Oh, man. Linda has in Appleton has buckthorn growing in her lawn and spreading every year. How does she get rid of it without killing the grass?
Wow. Well, hopefully it's small and seedlings. And so I think I would take two approaches. If it's small enough that you could mow it, one option would be to just mow it like you're mowing your lawn. If you wanted to make, if they're small, if you wanted to use a herbicide that's safe, like a broadleaf weed killer, use one that has triclopyr in it, and you could just treat those small plants, and that should effectively remove them if you wanted to use a herbicide. But repeated mowing should work. If the plants are too big to treat, to mow, you would have to use this cut surface treatment. Or there's other techniques. We're actually, Larry, right now, we probably don't have time to talk about it, looking at some non-chemical approaches for controlling these large shrubs where we're repeatedly cutting the plant at chest height, stripping all the leaves off, letting the plant resprout, coming back in September, restripping the leaves, coming back the next spring, restripping the leaves again. And we find if we can do that for a year, we can kill a large buckthorn tree or a large, and we're researching that on honeysuckle now. So if you're not interested in herbicides, there are alternative ways, but it's pretty labor intensive.
But you can find out, is that on your site as well?
That, we do have some information on our site as well, yeah.
Mark, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for being with us today. I really appreciate it. And I guess we won't be meeting again, but you'll be back with Lee Rayburn, I'm sure of that.
Yeah, thank you, Larry. It's been 20 years, and I've enjoyed my time with you, and I wish you all the best.
Thank you. Mark Wren's weed science professor and extension specialist at UW-Madison. Always been a pleasure talking with him over the years. And I look forward to more conversations with him. Coming up next, we're going to talk turkey. I'm Larry Mueller.